Today we've got a very interesting topic. We're looking at the House of Lords International Relations Committee report, which was published in May, called The Middle East, Time for New Realities. And I was saying to David Howell, as the chairman of that committee, that this is a very moving target, and I had a look at the report again last night, and many of the bits of it have already been superseded by events taking place in that part of the world. So it's a subject which is always constantly refreshing itself, and it's wonderful to have this team here today from that committee. I don't think I have to spend much time introducing David Howell. He's spoken here before. He's a member of my advisory panel. He was a Minister of State in the Foreign Office at the beginning of the Cameron government. And before that, he was for many years the chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the House of Commons. And before that, he was also the Secretary of State for Energy, which is where I think I first met him many, many years ago. So we have a man of immense experience in international relations. He chairs this committee, I'm told, with a very good spirit of guidance. And I look forward to hearing from him. On my left, who will speak second, I've got Lord Hanny of Chiswick, David Hanny, who, again, is a good attender of GSF meetings. He's a distinguished Foreign Office veteran, and again, I don't have to say too much. He was, as you know, the permanent representative to the EEC at that moment, and he was also the Minister of the British Embassy from 1985 to 1990. He was the UN Special Representative for Cyprus from 1996 to 2003, and he's also a member of this committee. He's written a number of books, the author of one called Cyprus, The Search for a Solution, New World Disorder, The United Nations After the Cold War, An Insider's View, and Britain's Quest for a Rail, a diplomatic memoir from Europe to the United Nations, all published by Ivy Torres. So if you want summer reading, there's a good selection for you. And we have today, I think, for the first time, which is great, another member of the committee, Baroness Helig, who is, she was William Hague's special advisor when he was Foreign Secretary. She started advising various people in the House of Commons when the Conservatives were in opposition as the advisor on defence. I think the worst moment she had was to discover she had me to advise for 6 short months, but it was made up for by the fact that William Hague then became the Shadow Foreign Secretary and she worked with him in opposition. And then again later, she worked for him when he became the Foreign Secretary. She's had a lot of responsibility for driving forward foreign policy priorities in various areas. She was very much the leading force behind our global initiative on preventing conflict-related sexual violence. She's a member of the Foreign Office Advisory Board on preventing sexual violence. She's a member of the Board of the Centre for Women, Peace and Security at the London School of Economics. And she's a board member of the ICC Trust for Victims. This year, she was appointed a member of the House of Lords Committee on International Affairs. I will ask her to speak last. I think we've got an excellent panel. Waste no more time, and we'll ask David to speak. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael, for that introduction. And this is indeed a most impressive turnout. It confirms my prejudiced view that the GSF is one of the best gathering places in London, if not in the United Kingdom, if not in the whole of Europe, if not in the Western world, for getting real grips to some of the new, endless new developments in the international landscape, some of which sometimes evade the grasp of the policy makers. The fact that also there's a delicious buffet always served, I know, is entirely marginal and nothing to do with the crowded room. It may be said straight away that our report, called The Middle East Time for New Realism, sounds a bit overambitious. How can one possibly tackle the Middle East in a single report or inquiry? But, of course, what we're trying to do is not deal with the endless variety of the different problems of the different and diverse societies, nations, cells and groups and factions throughout the whole Middle East region, but try and look at some of the fundamental changes in social structure and political structure and in interests and in the distribution of power in the Middle East region, which have gone on apace in very recent years. Even in the last 4 or 5 years, and the fundamental changes which we felt were also taking place in our own circumstances this end, as it were, in the United Kingdom here in Northern Europe, and the foreign policy implications and revised assumptions that would be needed in the light of both these two huge, as you say, Michael, moving targets. And thirdly, of course, there is always the age-old dilemma between realpolitik and moralpolitik, and I think we are groping in our committee towards realisation, as usual, the dilemma remains, but there is a new kind of realpolitik that we have to address in a hyper-connected world with a vast spread of the audiences and involvement of people in the determination of foreign policy measures and postures and policies. I should also add, again, following what Michael said, that we have been quite hard-pressed to keep up with events, and we published this in May. Since then, there's been a general election here. It didn't turn out too well for some of us, but there we are. Of course, but in the Middle East itself, we've seen a whole range of developments. As we slightly foreshadowed in our report, President Trump was going to become involved. He went down to Riyadh and received a royal welcome, but of course helped raise the temperature between the Gulf states and Iran, where some strange things are going on, and the arrest of Mr. Rouhani's brother seems to be a very odd trend inside an obviously not terribly stable society. Then we've had this odd spat between the GCC states. They're particularly odd because, of course, one always looked and in a way continues to look on the Gulf states as the one area of global stability in an otherwise completely turbulent and chaotic region. And for the two of the players and their acolytes and friends to fall out seems very strange business indeed. I'm not at the bottom of it. I listened to Mr. Gargash yesterday, who was visiting from the UAE, trying to explain why there's such a quarrel with Qatar. I'm afraid I was no wiser at the end. It turns out, at one moment, it's all to do with personalities, and the emir says this, and the emir says that. The next moment, it's to do with a long list of apparent crimes, of which there isn't very much substance. So I think that's a mystery. Others in the room may understand more what is going on there. I think they surely ought to be able to talk it out. Meanwhile, we have the Turkish scene looming over all this, with Mr. Erdogan helpfully adding that he intends to behead all his political opponents, not exactly creating an enlightened atmosphere at all there, the real language of a despot. More positively, even since we published, Mosul has fallen, and Tabqa has fallen, and they're closing in on Raqqa. So that's the territorial side of the caliphate coming to a closure, but of course that leaves the sort of franchised violence of a stateless Daesh free to rove around the world in its poisonous way, and look, we've already had tastes of it, tragic tastes of it, here in Manchester and London, and that there's a great fear for more. And finally, the refugee scene around the whole Middle East grows and grows and grows in its horror. About 6 million refugees languishing in camps in Greece, Turkey and Jordan and Lebanon. More refugees arriving by the hour. 12,000 in Italy alone last week. I see the Italians are now feeling so overwhelmed that they may lift the barriers and empower 200,000 of these refugees to move out of Italy into the rest of the EU. And that means, of course, the pressures on us in Northern Europe as well. So it's all very much on our doorstep. We asked, as you occasionally hear people ask, can we disengage from all this maelstrom? And our report concludes absolutely firmly that we cannot possibly disengage, even if we wanted to, but that our engagement must develop in radically changed ways in a radically changed Middle East. And behind that is the thought that technology is the unravelling the whole global order, including the Middle East. And indeed, one reservation I have about the government's reply to our report, which on the whole was helpful and supportive, was that there didn't seem to be much recognition of that basic fact, that if you spread more mobile telephones than there are human beings, you put everybody on the World Wide Web, if you connect up in a variety of instant ways on a scale never before known in history, you do change the whole structure of the bodies politic and bodies social that you're dealing with. Now, we address this whole turbulent scene on really three levels. First, we're looking at the sort of 100-year perspective and pointing out what is obvious to most, that the Middle East is no longer the vital and dominant oil and energy source that it was, although it's still very significant, and that the states which were born 100 years ago, at the time of Sykes-Picot and so on, the First World War, from the line in the sand carve-up by Britain and France, have been challenged and are being challenged now, and that Russia is back in the region with a vengeance, and that probably, I think this is a matter of divided opinions, but mine is frankly not divided at all. I'm absolutely convinced we're in for a long, long period of very weak oil and gas prices, and indeed a major shift away from hydrocarbons in the world energy pattern altogether. So that's long-term stuff, that's deep down, because deep down there was this view of the Middle East was vital for oil reasons and so on. Second, coming into the last few decades and really into this century, what have we seen? We've seen Iran and Syria fragment in hideous civil wars, both threatened existentially. We've seen the Israel-Palestine conflict, an inherited from the 20th century, harden and certainly not improve very much, and the status of Hamas unresolved, though there may be some signs of change there. We've seen the what we called the Arab Spring, so hopefully, and indeed the Foreign Office, in its response to our report, admits it was caught by surprise, turned to ashes almost everywhere, except maybe in Tunis. We've seen Egypt, enormous nation, the dominant Arab nation in the past, go through the full cycle from autocracy, the autocrat overthrown, then some kind of democracy from the street, and then that democracy turning out to be falsely based, back to military rule, and some kind of stability, which personally I hope survives, but it's precarious. And we've seen Iran become a little more amenable, although no one can be sure how far that goes, and it's certainly not the view of our friends in the Gulf states, which see Iran consolidating as an arc of power across Syria to its Hezbollah surrogate in Lebanon. And meanwhile, in this mid-range perspective, the whole region is, of course, looking much less to the west and more to the east. It's selling much more to the east. Most of the oil goes to the east, and the Russian and Chinese involvement, which would have been unimaginable even 20 years ago, is now very, very extensive. And then we come up to the present day and the boiling present situation. Trump's America emitting very uncertain messages. It's hard to see whether, you know, one week he's going to do a deal with Assad, the next week he's firing corrective missiles at him. The government's response in its reply to us seems to be that we just carry on with the USA as before. It's the bedrock, it's the link, we have to stick with them and so on. I'm not sure the committee agrees with that. Those of you who read it, we have doubts about whether one can depend so much on the assumption that America is going to underpin the entire security of the region as in the past. We have Russia and Turkey patching up their quarrels. We have the whole, we have Mr. Erdogan, I've already mentioned. Is Turkey in line with NATO still or not? I don't know. No, none of us know. It's very uncertain. Certainly giving up EU membership, that certainly has gone down the drain, as many of us thought it would. The whole region, the whole MENA region, Middle East and North Africa, one of extreme youth, 60% under 30, tens of millions unemployed, all of them empowered by digital communication technology, mobile, the web, social networks, the impact of which is, in my view, almost impossible to overstate. And furthermore, the microchip takes us into the world of weaponry, where there's a sort of what's being described as a Cambrian explosion in cheap and lethal high-tech weaponry, drones and missiles to hand, so that really every tribal group and cell now acquires immense and lethal firepower with which conventional forces find it more and more difficult to cope. And one has to look at the Yemeni scene, where well-equipped and conventional forces from Saudi Arabia, with some backing from outside and the UAE, are finding it harder and harder to defeat what amount to just a lot of rebels in rapidly moving trucks, very well-equipped also with weapons. And of course, through all this, there is the religious divisions, which in past centuries
blew up, but been over the period of time relatively, use that careful cut, were carefully relatively quiescent, and have now been disastrously inflamed. And the Iran nuclear deal is now in question, thanks to Mr. Trump and the US Congress making conditional remarks. And the Kurds are fighting, as always, for state identity. Actually, they're fighting as never before. And already I've mentioned that GCC states are quarrelling with each other. So there's a right fine mess, if ever there was one. And the question is, how do we feel our way forward in this ugly and bloody tangle of issues? Just to go through that as quick as I can. First, there are no comprehensive strategies. People say, well, we must have a strategy for the region. Quite impossible. The variety of problems are much too great. Second, post-Brexit, we're going to need to carve out our own course and define our own interests with less automatic reliance on the USA. That's what our committee leans towards. I know that Henry Kissinger, who one always listens to, has surmised the other day that Brexit could bring the US and the UK closer together. But of course, frankly, that depends on whether the USA itself turns away from protectionist, unpredictable and inward-looking policies, which on the trade side, it doesn't look as though it's frankly it's doing. The government response here has been to say nothing on this aspect. Maybe they don't feel they can. That is, I think, a little worrying. Thirdly, after Brexit, we're certainly going to need to sew together our relationships in a different way. We're going to work much more closely than ever with our neighbours. Nice piece of irony. Having left the European, we're going to have to work more closely with our European neighbours, especially France, with her enormous experience in the Middle East. Sometimes we've quarrelled with her, of course, but she has world power status. And generally, after Brexit, we're going to have to repackage our activities in the region, right, not just foreign policy, but security, culture and so on, in a different way. Fourthly, we think we should stick with the Iran nuclear agreement, the JCPOA, even if America doesn't. I'm not very unclear which way Washington is heading on Iran. Some say in the wrong direction, some say they're sort of overreacting to the alleged weakness or negativeness of the Obama policy. But if it's an overreaction, it'll probably go too far the other way. Fifth, the two-state solution for Israel-Palestine remains, in our view, the only feasible goal. Trump was dabbling in this when he went down to Riyadh and suggested, maybe with some, anyway, initial sense to it, that our enemy's enemy is our friend, and therefore the Arabs who fear Iran should get together more closely with Israel, both in physical terms, connecting up airlines and so on, and in other ways. I don't know whether that is the beginning of some other route away from the two-state solution, which we're always for, but nothing much has happened. I noticed Tony Blair, no less, saying that this is an opportunity to change the whole dynamic of the region in a positive way. I think one just has to say, well, let's hope. Sixth, we must need to strengthen all the old bilateral links and secure new ties, and in the words of the Prime Minister, foster old friendships and new partners. And that means with Jordan, always been supportive, with Lebanon, where we've been rather silently, but in fact extremely positively helpful in their agonizing divisions, which continue in a sort of precarious balance, with Tunis itself, where we hope that's one area where the Arab Spring sentiment may be operating, with Morocco, an old friend, and we should cement our already strong, friendships possibly with Algeria, if it can move forward a little, and maybe with a repaired Egypt, if that too can find stability. So we need to look for our friends, and we should intensify our soft power deployments on every front, not just trade and security, but through our considerable intellectual and creative firepower. So that's really, we're arguing that through the spearhead of our universities, we can open minds and close down old hatreds, just as frankly we have successfully done. Yes, he wants me to close. I'm coming to the last paragraph now. In the end, it's a battle between, not between so much religions or even states, but between moderate and extremist futures, two separate narratives and visions throughout the whole Middle East, one violent, and one peaceful. There are clear limits to what we can do, but we can play a strong part in the struggle, both through our own example here at home and through the utmost respect for the Muslim faith and by constant and vigorous support for the rules-based global order. That's the tone of our report. There are many details in it. Michael rightly wants me to shut up, and that I will do, but that's the picture for you. Please enjoy.
Well, thank you very much, Michael, for inviting me along again to this august gathering. I can actually slightly trump you on how long you've known my chairman in the International Relations Committee, because we first met in 1955 when we were doing our national service. So that does take you back rather a long way. I'll just pick out one or two themes of our report, which complement what David Harwell said. First theme, I think we, like Michelin guides, it's always wise to start with un peu d'histoire. And so we looked at the Middle East in the past century a little bit, when the role of outside powers was absolutely predominant, unhealthily so often, because many people who lived in the Middle East believed that they were pawns in a game which they didn't control, and the outside powers did. And we concluded that that era not completely disappeared, but largely disappeared, and that the outside powers no longer could call the shots, and their interventions could often prove to be counterproductive. So that goes for a whole range of issues. After our report was written, of course, we had President Trump going to Riyadh and giving the Saudis and their allies a blank check, not probably the wisest thing that he ever did. But the role of China needs to be taken into account too. We were struck by how congruent the role of China in the Middle East was with our own, with the view that what our biggest interest and their biggest interest is in stability, open trade, and so on. That doesn't prove that we can come up with joint policies, but it does show that there is no conflict there between our objectives. And we did also say that we thought that the old Franco-British rival in the Middle East should really be put behind us. There is no role for that any longer. And if the two of us are to continue to have some influence in a Middle East less dominated by external powers, then we're going to have to learn to work together better than we did in the past. Second theme, the rivalry between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Now, I'm not trying to take a position on the rights and wrongs of this rivalry, but merely to say that on looking at it, we could not, for the life of ourselves, see any British interest which was served by a continuation, let alone an accentuation or a slip into hostilities of that rivalry. It is not in our interest that it should continue. Does that mean we can stop it continuing? Well, of course it doesn't. But it does mean that we should not delude ourselves into thinking that this is something that is perfectly normal, it's fine, we don't need to worry about it. We do need to worry about it because it could slip out of control, and that would be very damaging for our interests in stability, open trade, investment, and so on in the region. And we should remember that the last time we tried to take sides between a Sunni Arab country and Iran in the Iran-Iraq war, it wasn't a huge success. We ended up in bed with Saddam Hussein, and we created the conditions of the hostility between Iran and the Western world, which has continued ever since. Then Arab-Israel, of course we had to take that into account. We didn't try, it would have been pretty stupid to do so, to come up with any particularly new ideas about how to deal with it. But we did conclude that there was absolutely no indication that a solution based on anything but a two-state solution would bring peace and stability to Israel, to Palestine, and to all the countries around it. And we concluded that the best way the British government could demonstrate that without disturbing unduly the activities that President Trump has initiated, which one can have a little bit of scepticism as to whether they're going to get anywhere, but without interfering with that, we did think that it was time that the British government recognised the state of Palestine. Not, of course, in any way separating itself from the need for an outcome which guarantees Israel's security, the borders that were established long, long ago, and so on. Then another theme we looked at was perhaps summed up rather loosely as stability versus democracy. And that we struggled a bit with. I think in the end we concluded that, of course, we must not and could not turn our backs on countries which were genuinely making some progress towards democratic institutions, of which Tunisia, Morocco, Jordan, Lebanon are some examples. There aren't many, alas. And so we did not think that, however strongly we advocated greater stability, we should do that at the expense of supporting countries which were moving towards democracy. But equally, we did feel that we should not be going around stirring things up and proclaiming, as some Western leaders did only a few years ago, that achieving democracy at almost any price was better than working with rulers who are there now. Not perhaps a very brave conclusion, but I think a realistic one. And then we did also look at the issue of states' ability. Whether states that were under threat of breaking up, and there are plenty around, Syria, Iraq, Yemen, Libya, whether we should be favouring that, or whether we should be supporting centralised states in those countries. And again, we took a perhaps not very courageous decision that we shouldn't really be doing either of those things. That we should not certainly favour the breakup, that all this loose talk about Sykes-Picot is dead and let's take a red pencil out and draw some new lines is extraordinarily dangerous and liable to lead to massive ethnic cleansing and many, many fatalities in a region which already has far too many of them. So we felt that the British government needed to work fully with regional entities like the Kurdish regional government and whatever might or might not emerge in Syria and indeed in Libya, but it should not be encouraging the breakup of those states in any way, and it should not be encouraging, for example, the Kurds to believe that there was an option for independence for Kurdistan which could be achieved other than wading through blood. So that was roughly where we came out there. Easier said than done, you might say, to work with these because there are tensions between the central government and regional governments, but we do seem to be doing it relatively successfully in Iraq, where I think a lot of effort is going into working both with the government in Baghdad and with the government in Erbil. Iranian nuclear, as the chairman said, we came out firmly of the view that the JCPOA was a major step forward. It was one of the few occasions when a potential dispute over nuclear weapons was solved by diplomacy rather than by other means. It needs to be preserved. Probably the best way to preserve it is for the five of the P5 plus one, that's everyone except the Americans, to make it clear that if the Americans try to tear it up, they'll be on their own. I don't think they'll much like that. And it is interesting to note that none of the candidates, not even the most fundamentalist candidates in the Iranian presidential elections, want to tear the agreement up. So I think it's there to be saved. I hope it will be saved. And I think we do need to start thinking about what follows it, what follows the end of the 15-year period, which is one of the weaknesses of that agreement because it is a relatively short term. And there we supported some ideas, which I have to admit came from an article that I wrote with Tom Pickering, a much more distinguished person than me, who knows a great deal about the Middle East. and where we suggested that we should be looking towards a way of globalising and generalising the constraints on the Iranian nuclear programme so that other countries all around the world, including the five permanent members, who are all observing a moratorium on the creation of new fissile material, were brought within the scope of it. And I think that is worth following up. The government's reaction to that was Delphic to the point of obscurity, but at least they didn't say no. And then finally, I do think that the thesis we advanced, that Britain needs to take a careful look at the whole region and try to work out some broad lines of policy that are likely to be different from the ones in the past, does not yet seem to have penetrated the walls of King Charles Street, judging at least by the response the minister gave in the debate we had, and which he produced no ideas as to new policies at all. I do hope that will be so. I think the arrival of Alistair Burt back in the Foreign Office as the Middle East Minister is a thoroughly positive event, and I hope that that will lead to them taking some of the prescriptions, at least, in this report reasonably seriously. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for inviting me, and I must say I feel a bit nervous following from two experienced sort of diplomats and politicians and members of the committee. This is my first time that I'm on the committee, and I got this invitation to come and join you a couple of days ago, accepted it with enthusiasm, only to come in here and see all of you. So I don't know whether that was a smart or not so smart decision. But what I would like to say, and the Lord Chairman and Lord Haney have already given a good and comprehensive update on where the committee came up to. I will give you, if I may, my personal perspective on this. As I say, this is my first committee, my second inquiry, and I approach this with a huge enthusiasm because I left Foreign Office 3 years ago, and I was, if you want, in terms of someone who works on foreign policy and defence issues, very excited and privileged to be there at the beginning of and during the Arab Spring and everything that it has produced in both, if I may say, positive and sort of negative outcomes. And I have three observations. As I say, I approached it as almost a study of the region that I used to spend a lot of time thinking about. So I expected that 2017 would be a better year for the countries of the Middle East than what happened a few years before. I was a little bit disappointed. I expected more robust and common front of and unity in the face of terrorism and radicalizations, both regionally amongst the GCC countries, but also wider. And when I say wider, I mean on I think about the United Kingdom, United States, and European Union. And I expected to learn more on how much the region has developed and whatever issues, whether positive or negative, that it was facing, where it is in 2017. And what I found quite interesting is that I actually learned more about the United Kingdom. Not to say that we haven't uncovered and studied many changes that have taken place in the region. But what really kind of, I wouldn't say shocked me, but it did in a certain way, is that I realized that against the background of the changes that the Lord Chairman has so well presented to all of you, one thing that comes very vividly across is that the energy and resources of the Foreign Office and of the United Kingdom government have been entirely spent on two major priorities. One is Brexit, and the other one is counterterrorism. And one cannot argue that there is ever too much energy spent on counterterrorism, because the security of this country, the people who live in this country, of our allies and our friends, of course, should always be at the forefront of our minds. But I must say, to narrow it to the point where we busy ourselves with Brexit mostly and counterterrorism may not be the smartest way long term. because the rest of the world outside of these two priorities has not stopped, and the events that are unfolding will, if not immediately, in the future have consequences upon ourselves as well. And I say this with regret, as I believe that we are facing uncertainty not only because of the events that we cannot predict, but because we, not only at home, but outside of our own borders, we lack element of leadership, an element of unity, which is in a huge deficit, and we never needed it more. And if I can just illustrate on two examples where this is most striking to me. One is Yemen, where millions of Yemenis are facing food insecurity, cholera, and potential famine. And this is entirely to do with a man-made disaster, including Saudi-led coalition operations in the country. And I believe that whatever the complexities, and I know there are many, and I know that there are different major players in the region that have part to play in this, that whatever these complexities are of the conflict, it is entirely unacceptable that we, as a country, have not put our full weight behind diplomatic efforts together with our allies, whether they come from European Union or whether they come from the United States or regionally, wherever we have them, to ensure immediate and unfettered access to food, medical supplies, and humanitarian assistance. And the suffering of Yemen has also highlighted existing public concerns about use of UK defence exports in Saudi Arabia. And here we also see the discrepancy between how we think about it and how Washington thinks about it, which from my very limited experience, I spent 10 years focusing on foreign policy and, you know, 4 years in the Foreign Office, I find very odd that we don't have a united front in dealing with this, not only because of humanitarian and moral issues, but because of our own security issues. And the other example, if I may give here, is the way in which we have collectively responded to Saudi Arabia-led GCC caucus of the countries and their efforts to foreclosure of Al Jazeera. Now, whatever we think of Al Jazeera, and you know, some may like it, some may not like it, in terms of the content, that's a very good TV station, and whatever we think about them, I cannot understand why we can stand on the sidelines and allow interference of one country into freedom of expression in another country and not to have a common stance, whether that comes from Washington, London, or Brussels. And I'm afraid this illustrates the lack of unity and lack of leadership, which has been particularly obvious since the new incumbent in Washington. So this leaves me hoping that there will be some element of self-correction, both here in London and in Washington. I'm hoping that that will happen, and that in the near future, a clarity, both in terms of thinking and acting and working together in the region, together with our EU allies, will emerge. And I am not naive. I know there are very many tensions internally in all these capitals, and there are very many other issues that are currently concern us. But I am I entirely understand that, and I'm prepared to accept that there will not be a total unity. But I do think that it is not to insist on consistency, compromise, and leadership. It will be seen in the future as abdication of our own responsibility towards our own security and towards our own futures. Thank you.